Welcome back, I'm Erin. And this is part two of the interview with author and podcaster Jenny from the Down and Away podcast. In the episode, Jenny references several open letters that Fred Murray wrote that were originally posted on John Smith's website. You can find links to those letters in the show notes or on my website at moramurraypod.com. Once again, a huge thank you to Jenny for doing this. And here is part two of the interview.
Okay. I want to talk about the condo, the Linda Salamone. Is that how you pronounce it? Condo?
I think so.
because it's used often as a way sometimes to bolster the notion that since Maura called a place that was larger with two bedrooms, that she must have been traveling with a companion. But I wonder, do we even know what she looked at on the internet or what listing that made her call in the first place? Do we even know if the condo was described or that she knew it was two bedrooms when she called?
So I don't know whether it was on the internet in 2004. I do know that she had stayed at that condo in July of 2003. So it was a place that she was familiar with. So she may have just had the number in her phone or written down somewhere. And that's why she decided to call Linda about that condo. And I do know that Sharon Rausch, when she was helping Fred investigate after the fact, she had called Linda and talked to her about it, and Linda had said that it was the cheapest one that she had. So I think that was probably more of a factor than necessarily the number of rooms. But I will say that it is on the internet now, and the ad that's on the internet shows that it's a one-bedroom, describes it as a one-bedroom condo.
Oh, does it?
Yeah, and I think that it has like a loft where it has like kid bunk beds. So maybe that's where the two-bedroom comes from. I'm not really sure. But at least the ad that's out there now, it does describe it as a one-bedroom condo.
So it's hard to say because we can't really know what she saw. That may, if anything, like you said, she could have just had the phone number because they had rented a condo, whether it was that one or another one in that, what is it, a group of condos or something in that area?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so it's hard to say other than the fact that we know she knew the area and liked the area. We certainly can't jump to the conclusion that she was calling it because it had two bedrooms. That's a bridge too far. So I think that's a misconception that I see out there a lot. And you really, you know, I think that's sort of stretching it to say that she called that place because she knew that it had two rooms. We have no idea what she was looking at.
Right. I would go so far as to say it's blatantly false because we know that she called one condo, one, looking for a place to stay. Presumably, Linda doesn't really remember her conversation with Maura. So she couldn't really say that much. But to say that, you know, she called one place that may have had one bedroom, may have had two, may have had one with kid bunks, and say that she was exclusively looking for two-bedroom hotel rooms is just false. Like, we can't know that. Like, it makes way more sense that it was a place that she'd stayed before and it was cheap.
Yeah.
that makes way more sense, especially because there weren't things like Expedia and hotels.com and stuff like that. Like, often you did rely on the places that you'd stayed in the past.
Right, that you knew. Exactly. Yeah. To me, that makes the most sense, is that they had been there. So she knew the area. And it probably had nothing to do with the actual condo itself. I mean, whatever she wanted to do was probably not in the condo. It was probably just a matter of convenience. All right. There was a pretty stunning allegation that Maura and a close friend were invited to an after-hours party at the athletic pool with upperclassmen who were described as now prominent businessmen. The allegation goes on to say that Maura had sex with three men and, quote, only one of the men involved in the gangbang ever spoke to police after his ex-girlfriend suggested to local detectives he might be involved with Maura's disappearance. So first of all, who is this close friend that allegedly went to this soiree with Maura?
So supposedly that was Kate Markopoulos. And Kate denies that this event ever happened. Yes, there were parties in the pool. I think most people in athletics knew that if you had a key to the varsity gym, you could use the pool after hours. It was pretty common. But in terms of the events that this author is suggesting, somebody who was there completely denies that this ever happened. And unfortunately, we don't know who the, quote, prominent businessman is to check, to corroborate.
Yeah, it says businessmen, plural. So these alleged people that were supposed to believe all three had sex with Mara, none of them were willing to give their names about it. And, you know, we don't have any corroboration from anybody that says it's even true.
Well, so if you read what he actually writes, only one of the people that was there, supposedly there, says that it happened. The other two just heard about it.
Right.
So that's not a source. That's the echo chamber of some crazy rumor, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So really there's one person that is supposedly saying this. I'd also point out that I don't know necessarily why we would be taking his account as credible when his ex-girlfriend supposedly said that he might have something to do with Mara's disappearance. That part seems to be overlooked quite often, and I don't really understand why.
Yeah, the whole story is concerning to me as an author. This would not have made my book. This story mm-hmm. would not have made my book. For one thing, it does not a single thing to further the investigation. If you can't get anyone to corroborate, it's the same as the Fred thing, the allegations against Fred.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have a single actual fact to corroborate something and it's that salacious of a piece of information, maybe you need to hold that information. Maybe you need to wait till you can get some further information about it because, you know, there's no reason for that. I don't understand why it's in there at all. That actually irritated me when I read that.
Oh, it infuriated me.
Yeah.
It still does. I mean, it's just gratuitous nonsense. Even if it's true, what difference does it make?
Yeah.
It's the definition of, I don't really like this term, but slut shaming. If these people have nothing to do with anything, what difference does it make if it is true? So yeah, I have a real problem with that one because basically it's just a way of trying to characterize or trying to paint a picture about Mara's character as some sort of like sexual deviant.
Yeah.
That was what its value in the book was to me. That was my interpretation.
Yeah. And you know, as a writer myself, the first thing that hit my mind is, wow, I hope they fact check that because that's stunning. You know, that's, I don't even know what to say anymore, but I guess we'll just leave it there.
Yeah.
But I would say that I would take that story as a whole with a huge boulder of salt over my shoulder until I had some names associated with it, especially that the close friend says it never happened. You know, that just already is right. A red flag.
Yeah. And I don't know why that part wasn't in the book. That's it was a pretty conspicuous omission as well.
Yeah. That she denied that it happened. Yeah, exactly. All right. So there's a sighting at a Butson's. I guess, is this a store? Is it a grocery store or something?
Mm-hmm.
And apparently where there was a cashier at the supermarket who thought that she may have seen Mara with two women who had out-of-state licenses about an hour before she disappeared. And I guess the theory about these women suggests that Mara was traveling with some companions. And, you know, it seems like they're trying to suggest it was Kate and or Sarah. Do we have any idea how seriously that law enforcement takes this sighting relative to it being Mara?
It's hard to say how seriously they take the sighting. I know that they did look into it. But I think that the staff person who reported it, she does exist. I do know that. And she did report this. But her shift ended, I think, at like 5:45. So it was actually almost 2 hours before Mara crashed at 7, you know, around 7:30. So an hour and a half at least. So the timing is a little off. But they did look into it. There were no ATM surveillance or anything like that, so they couldn't check that. But I don't think that there was anywhere to go with it necessarily. They didn't have any way of tracking, of following it up any further.
And didn't in Fred's, I'm not sure if it was in Fred's interview with you that I read this, or I read it somewhere, didn't he mention that the sighting had been of two blondes with someone that looked like Mara?
Right. Yep. And so Kate and Sarah both are dark haired.
Okay.
So I don't think that it was Kate and Sarah to begin with, but it's unlikely that it was them based on the description that was given.
Okay. All right.
And also Kate and Sarah, just to add one thing,
uh-huh.
I feel like it, because those are the only friends that people are aware of that Mora had, they sort of get thrown into like every theory that's out there. But they weren't independently friends, like apart from Mora. They might have just hung out that one time, the Saturday before she disappeared. So there was no reason necessarily for them to be traveling together. That would seem like kind of a leap, considering they didn't really know each other.
Yeah, and the other thing I feel like I need to point out and keep pointing out to people is that, let's say you believe that that was Kate and Sarah with Mora, then you have to believe that they have spent last over a decade hiding something that they know and not telling police. Both of these two people that weren't friends independent of Mora, for whatever reason, had something that was big enough that they would be lying to police and risking, you know, perjury charges or whatever. And you know, that's something that you need to factor into your theories. You know, what is it that they're hiding that they are willing to get themselves into trouble and jammed up? You know, there's a lot of problems that I have with that. But that's the main one, is that motivations. I'm not lying for someone like that. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing that when cops come to me and I'm going to lie to them. No, I'm not that kind of friend. Sorry. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, it would have to be pretty extreme and quite the conspiracy, I think, for that to be the case. And there's just no evidence for it. That's always good to point out. There's no evidence whatsoever.
Exactly. And there was also a statement from the author that alleges that Helena had told him, quote, "Sarah would never talk to me or any other reporter, and that she'd told the real story to Fred and was asked never to repeat it." The first thing I'm going to do, because that was another issue that Fred, I'll ask your thoughts on that, but I want to quote Fred himself in one of these open letters. So Fred said of the author, quote, "He has asserted as basic fact that I asked Mora's friends to not talk to him. This, of course, is another false allegation taken from his list of misrepresentations that he has tried to foist on you. The reality is that I said the girls should, quote, play it the way they saw it. I wasn't going to chance it because I didn't trust him based on his unfounded and mean-spirited hatchet job on his personally manufactured suspect, Dean Runkle, in the Amy Mihaljevic case. I don't think unjust collateral damage matters to him if it is likely to enhance his readership and thus his profit." And the reason why I quote that very strong statement is because the statement against Fred is very strong, and I feel like he deserves to have his voice heard here. And so have you talked to him about this whole thing where Fred's allegedly telling his, you know, Mora's friends not to talk to him or anyone?
Yeah. And according to Mr. Murray, it is 100% false. He said that, particularly as it pertains to Sarah, he only spoke to her once and she was very vague and really couldn't tell him anything at all. She said that she was asleep the whole time. And I think that he explains that in the interview that I did with him, that she really didn't have much to say. But as to whether he asked her not to say anything or there was a real story or anything like that, that is 100% false. So he was pretty clear about that.
And the use of the word real is really interesting there to me, because I don't know where that word comes from. Who said the real story thing, where that word comes from, but it implies just by its usage that there is some not real story out there, you know, like that we don't know about. You know, it's an implication, a very subtle implication that's inaccurate as far as we know, factually inaccurate. And another thing he says in this letter is, an example is his implying that Sarah Alfieri told me the whole story. Sarah told me during the only time I talked to her that she was, quote, asleep the entire time. And nothing more. So that's all she told him. That's all he knows from Sarah. That's it.
Yep.
You know, and what is this reference people make to Sarah saying, "I don't want to get my friend in trouble"? What is this about?
So I do think that she said that. I think that that was in an early report. It's hard to know exactly what she was referring to. And as far as she knows, like, I don't necessarily think she would have known that this was going to become a big missing persons case. And so I thought when I read that was, well, she doesn't want to say that Mora was drinking at her dorm before she got into a car accident, because that would look pretty bad. That would get her in trouble.
Yeah.
So that was my take from it, but it's hard to know exactly what she was referring to. And I guess they didn't probe and ask her to clarify it all, but I think that's what it might have been. Or alternatively, you know, they had been hanging out with those three guys, and maybe she didn't want to say that, not knowing, you know, that Moore had disappeared. Like, maybe she thought she was coming back. She didn't want to get her in trouble with her boyfriend and put their relationship in jeopardy for no good reason. So
yeah,
that's purely speculation, but I think that those are plausible explanations for what she was referring to.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I thought, that for the alcohol thing came first. We know that she was drinking when she went out to eat with her dad, and then they bought some alcohol. So it's pretty easy to infer that they were drinking. Now, when she stopped or she didn't, there's a police report that I read that even Fred said, I told her she could have gotten arrested for DUI or popped for, however he said it in the report. But that was it, what he was thinking too, you know? So that makes sense that that's what Sarah would be worried about. You know, she crashed her dad's car. She doesn't want to make the situation worse, you know? So that makes sense to me. And right. Also, she's not going to want to be saying that, oh, she left, if she left with this guy, she's, you know, those are things that she's not going to be wanting to just tell anyone for no reason. And if that's all she knows, that's all she knows, you know?
Yeah.
So, and frankly, this idea that these girls have never talked, I don't understand it. They talk to police, you know, what more do you want from them? If they only have a limited amount of information, what do they have to gain from coming out and have people attack them when they've already been attacked so much in print already?
Right.
It doesn't benefit them to do that. I wouldn't even recommend it.
Right. And one other, it occurred to me that one other reason she may have thought that she didn't want to get more in trouble is because Sarah, I believe, wasn't drinking age yet. She hadn't turned 21.
Oh.
So maybe she was thinking that, oh, well, if Maura purchased alcohol for a minor or something like that, like it could be something so juvenile, yeah. Sort of. I mean, like what I would consider juvenile now, but, you know, at the time, it could be a big deal to them. But to your point about whether Sarah and Kate spoke to reporters and to the media, it's not true that they refused to speak to the media and to reporters. They're quoted in a lot of articles. I know that Kate was part of the investigative piece that 17 magazine put out. I think that she spoke to a lot of journalists, really anyone that wanted to speak to her. It was just that she stopped speaking to reporters and journalists after she had done this interview with the author, where he subsequently published a bunch of completely irrelevant information about her father and some of his legal issues, and none of it had anything to do with Maura, and even went so far as to kind of implicate Kate in Maura's disappearance in a number of different ways, some of which we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's nothing to be gained at this point. For speaking out. And I think that they've learned that. They've learned that lesson, unfortunately, the hard way.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the second person we've tossed also that stopped talking. And then you have to start to ask yourself where the common denominator is here. How many other people stopped talking after they got attacked by someone digging into a case and being aggressive with them? How many other people do we know of that stopped talking because of that, that we can't access anymore if we want to because of the way they were treated, you know?
I can give you one example. Mark Ruddick, who was the officer in Hadley, the night that she crashed her dad's Corolla, he won't speak to anyone now because of how negative it is. And that's really unfortunate because I know a lot of people don't subscribe to the speeding ticket theory, the idea that she found out that maybe her license was suspended in New Hampshire, but I do know that it was possible because I talked to, I do have a contact at the Hadley Police Department, and it certainly would have been possible, but the only way we could know that is by speaking to Officer Ruddick.
And that's unfortunate. And again, what are the common denominators? From my perspective, when you want to talk to someone about something as intimate as a missing person, a loved one, something like that, you have to establish a relationship with someone. You're not just, you know, this isn't a wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, you know, corner someone to get them to talk. You're not a cop. You're a writer trying to get the most out of each person. And in order to do that, I have found the best way to do it is to give them the time to decide that they can trust you in order to open up about these things. And that's why I've never had anyone refuse to come back and talk to me about a case, because you know, I take no for an answer, first of all. And second of all, you know, I always try to put myself in that person's shoes, you know, and like you said, at some point, there's no benefit to people coming back and answering questions if they're going to be treated that way. So I just thought that was something that we definitely should point out. Okay, there's a couple Fred questions that I asked you to ask him. And so the first one was, did he know about the author's firing from the 2009, from the Cleveland scene and the controversy around that before he told him no in 2010, as far as talking to him about Moore's case?
So it's unclear exactly if he knew specifically about that filing, but he did say that him and Helena Murray looked into the author because he was considering it. And what they found, he called undesirable details of previous work and the quote hatchet job, use that term again, in the Amy Mahalovic case, that one of the cases that he had covered. And so he decided not to take a chance on this author. And I know that Mr. Murray, he reiterated that on the Oxygen series and said exactly that. Like he didn't think that he'd be able to trust him with the truth, with being consistent about telling the truth. And so that's why he chose not to be a part of that book. And I think it's, you know, the way that it's framed is like, what father doesn't want media attention on his daughter?
Yeah.
And yeah, that's just ridiculous, because just because he doesn't want this specific type of media attention, and it turns out was probably the right call, it doesn't mean that he didn't want media attention. I mean, at the same time, he had been doing the Montel Williams show. He did like the Disappeared episode, I think it was 2009, 2020. That was national. I know that Moore had been featured on CNN, Greta Van Susteren. There was plenty of very high profile national news coverage. And from what I know, they still engage the media today. So
yeah,
I think that should just stop being reiterated, because it's not true that they didn't want media attention. It's just they didn't want one specific author's media attention.
Right. That notion of this father did not want national coverage and I want to know why. We need to disabuse the listeners right now from the idea that all coverage is good coverage. It is not. All coverage is not good coverage. National coverage, first of all, isn't always necessary in every case. Sometimes when you know what you need to be looking at is local, you need to focus local. You don't need to be, it's not important that everyone in the country knows this person's name. Now, a family wanting to get it out there, I get it, because that, you know, you want as many people to hear it as you can. But the idea that because he didn't want national attention is wrong, because like you said, he did a lot of national media. So I want people to understand that that's absolutely inaccurate.
Right.
So the $4,000 in Fred, there's some question and some people theorize other things about this. And I wanted to ask you, did Maura have access to the account that Fred used to take the $4,000 out of on the day that the money was taken from the ATMs? Because I think the allegation is that it wasn't Fred taking the money out to begin with.
Right. So I asked him that, and no, she did not have any access to that account. That was his account, and he was the only person that could access it.
Okay.
So it wasn't her that took out the money. It was him.
Right. And then regarding that $4,000 for the car shopping, I just wanted to clear up, because I think he has answered this, but I wanted to make sure. Why did he stop multiple places rather than going inside and getting cash from a teller? Do you know?
Yeah. So I know that he mentioned this in the Oxygen show as well, but his bank at the time was in Hanson, Mass., which is in Eastern Mass. Near Boston. And he was working in Bridgeport, Connecticut, which is probably, I'd guess, like two and a half hours or so. And so he didn't have like the time to get to his bank branch during business hours. So instead, he just took the money out of the ATMs and I think he said $500 increments. But that's why he did that. It was because, you know, it was before the time of the big banks sort of swallowing everything up. Like, local little banks still existed before the 2007, 2008 crash. So that's the reason. It's just because there wasn't a local bank branch. That's it.
Yeah. I routinely go to ATMs over going inside, even for large sums of money. I'll go to a couple. I just don't like going in, and I only ever get to the bank on the weekend when, you know, so that's the reason. Like, my branches close early, so I routinely do that. So there's nothing weird about that. I don't know why that got blown up. And the other thing that got blown up sort of associated to that was that people saying that Kate not knowing about them going car shopping is somehow an indicator that they didn't go car shopping. But I just want to analyze that a minute. First of all, anyone that's gone car shopping knows that it's awful. And at least for me, I hate going car shopping. I can't stand it. It's like an all-day affair. It's a drama. And, you know, who knows, that they were doing it for however many hours that day, whatever. And then by the time they went to get something to eat, they were probably over it because they didn't get what they wanted. And now Fred's going to have to come back again. So this isn't a pleasant thing. It's not like, oh, wee, you know, it's a chore to get done. And now he has to take another weekend of his time and come back, you know. The other thing is he's forking over a big hunk of money to get his kid's car. And he's not a rich guy. I am certain that he was glad to do it because he wants his daughter driving a safe car. But, you know, I don't think, knowing what you said about Mara earlier, because I was like this too, that she was all that crazy about her dad having to give her that much money. It's embarrassing. You don't want to put your parents out, for especially for that much money, if you don't have to. So, you know, she seemed like the type of person that wanted to do things herself. I was like that, so I completely understand it. So I can understand that that would be an uncomfortable or embarrassing, you know, topic to talk about in front of Kate. Why would why would you expect them to talk about that? You know, it just doesn't make sense to me.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that that's exactly it. It sounded like she hated accepting help from people. And so at some level, it was probably a matter of pride. Like, she didn't want to admit that she needed the help, even though she did. And to that point, I think that I remember Bill saying to me that he had actually offered her his car. I don't know if it was the Saab or like an older car that he had in Ohio, but she would get mad at him. She would get angry and say, you know, I don't need your help. I don't need you to save me and stuff like that. So like, it was definitely like a sticking point for her. Like, she didn't like to accept help, and it probably bothered her a lot that she was having to for her nursing program, but she really didn't have a choice. They had to have a car. It was one of the requirements for that program, that they had their own personal private transportation. So there wasn't really any way around it. And yeah. And so I can completely understand why she didn't necessarily want to highlight that when they're out later trying to relax and have a good time.
Yeah.
And she did tell Bill about the car shopping. So it's not like she didn't tell anyone. He knew about it, and he knew that they had specifically gone to one of the locations that he had purchased his own car a few years prior. There was also a call to Reliance Auto in her phone record that day, and that's an auto dealership salvage place in the Amherst area. So there's plenty of evidence, other evidence, to suggest that they were car shopping. It's just that she didn't tell Kate, I guess.
Yeah, and there's another thing I wanted to point to, that Fred Murray, another quote that he said in that letter, it's the last one, I'll quote from there. But so he said, the inaccuracies throughout are too numerous to detail here, but to show that this style is no accident, I will direct you to the What We Have Learned So Far section of the blog. There are 5 references to me, and each one is false, inaccurate, and orchestrated to distort and deceive, and how it relates to me personally and can be readily discredited. One is a particularly easily demonstrable example of an attempt to mislead. You don't have to be overly sharp to find a clear indication of this in Mora's phone records for Saturday, February 7th, 2004, which he carelessly presented on his blog on Sunday, January 11th, 2015, thus undercutting the main bulwark of his own position concerning our not looking for a used car. The Reliance Auto sales call at 4:13 p.m. refutes his stance on there being no evidence of this search. I also hold unassailable, tangible proof obtained that day from there and elsewhere for support. So he literally has physical evidence to show that they were searching for a car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there was also, in her phone records from the month prior, there were also calls to car dealerships. So it's not like this was a new problem. And the nursing student that had given her a ride the week before to clinicals had written to Terry O'Connell, who is he's a private investigator, lawyer, and told him that it was pretty well known that Maura's car was out of commission. She needed a ride. I was giving her a ride because her car had broken down at the beginning of the semester and she was looking for a new one. So there's plenty of corroboration, it seems, that she was, in fact, looking for a new car that weekend. And that's why Fred was there.
Okay. So I think we've handled that one, you know, as best we can. I mean, people that are going to have these theories are going to have them. But I, you know, I think facts are important. And if he's got, you know, actual proof, then we really shouldn't be, you know, bothering with that anymore. So the UMass cabin, we talked about that earlier a little bit, but some of these theories tend to have an idea that perhaps that was her destination that night. And, you know, these theories involve maybe other people going with her or, you know, different things about that. And so I want to make sure everyone is aware of some points. First of all, the cabin is a quarter mile hike in from the parking lot. There is no electricity. Mm-hmm. There is running water only during the fall and the spring. So there would have been no running water. It would have been frozen over. And the bathroom facilities are a two-stall outhouse. So I think just from that perspective, we can rule out any idea that she was going on some romantic interlude there. That's not happening. If you can't take a shower, that's let's just rule that out right now. I also don't see two or three girls hiking half a mile into wherever they're going to hang out and drink or whatever, you know, and can't take showers. They have no electricity. It's out in the boonies. It just doesn't make sense. If that's your theory, that a friend or friends were spiriting her away from something, men in her life or dangerous or whatever, why are they taking her to a place where you'd have to pee outside in February in New Hampshire? I mean, you know, like, it doesn't make sense to me. I don't understand where this comes from. Do you know why they keep focusing on this UMass cabin?
Well, I think, no, those are good points. I don't think people know that about the UMass cabin, about how really remote it is. That said, I think, you know, if any person were to not be necessarily bothered by the hike and peeing outside, it might be Maura. But I don't necessarily think that there's any reason to think that she was going to the UMass cabin. I know that a lot's been made of the fact that Haas was a part of the outing club and the outing club managed the cabin. So maybe she knew about the cabin. But I want to say that most people on campus probably knew about the cabin because the outing club is by far like the biggest student organization at UMass. And even if you weren't a part of it, you could still go on outing club trips. And the big selling point that the group would always try to highlight when they tried to get students to sign up was that they managed this cabin. So most people knew about it. But that doesn't mean that they had any reason to think that she could have accessed it. I mean, I think that you needed a combination. You needed to be able to like know how to get in and out. There's just no evidence that she would have known those things and no evidence that she had any contact with Haas or anyone else that would have had that information. So I see why people look at it because it's in Bethlehem, New Hampshire, which isn't too far from where she crashed. But I just don't think that there's been any reason really to think that that's what her ultimate destination was.
And also, why is she calling the Salamones and other places for if she knows about this place already? If she knows about the cabin, why is she calling the Salamone? Why is she calling, you know, Gosto? She doesn't need to make those calls if she knows about the cabin, this free place to stay that she doesn't mind going to. You know, just sort of doesn't make sense with what we know she did, you know?
Right. Yep, exactly. And for all she knew, there could have been people there. Like, she had no way of knowing what the schedule was. And I think that there were people there the weekend before and the weekend after. I don't know if they were there during the week. But yeah, she had no way to know that she wouldn't come upon, like, a full cabin. People had already had, you know, rented it out or were using it. So
exactly. That's true. We have no indication that she's sending emails asking about it or whatever. So I think it's, you know, it's probably unlikely that that was a place that she would have been headed. Just a couple things I wanted to mention with regard to reporting as a writer, things that stand out to me when I'm going through all this information, red flags, things like that. I think it's important to note any time that there are an abundance of instances where anonymous sources with zero corroboration are used. Because the more of those are not, the more you rely on anonymous sources, to me, the less that the you can say, you know, for sure that you understand the context of what's being reported, because you're relying on one person to, you know, give you that information rather than getting it directly from the source. I just don't feel like you're doing your job as a journalist if you leave out context that allows the reader to make their own judgments about who is telling these stories and their credibility, rather than relying on your slant. You know, that's called feeding people a narrative. So that's one thing. Another big thing that we talked about a little bit is instances where the interviewees will not speak to the interviewer after the first interview. When those start piling up, you have to ask yourself what's being done by the interviewer to keep these people from wanting to speak out. You know, that's concerning. And then when someone's in a hurry to report breaking news and then they have to walk it back, that's, you know, another thing, or take down blogs or things like that. And I also think that it's never good when it appears that someone who is doing writing or reporting is posting accusatory and bullying things in an effort to get someone to talk to them. And then they remove those posts after they get someone to agree with them. And someone suggesting that if someone won't talk to him or her, that's suspicious. Yeah, it's suspicious, but it's not suspicious on the person that doesn't want to talk to you. It's suspicious that you are suggesting that it is suspicious that they don't want to talk to you.
Right.
You know what I mean? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So those were things that popped out to me as far as when I evaluate someone's writing, you know, and I do it every day. We all do it. You should. We all should. When you're taking in media information, you should look at it and try to see, can I fact check this with another source? And if I can't do that, if there's no way to fact check it at all, you know, what level of comfort do I have with that information? So that's just something that I personally wanted to put out. Okay, so I have a couple just statements I'm going to read. These are basic fact checks. So the first one was a statement that read, there were two women who were with Maura at UMass prior to her disappearance, Kate Markopoulos and Sarah Alfieri. Both have refused repeatedly to speak to journalists and have been uncooperative with police. Were they uncooperative with police, as far as you know?
As far as I know, no. They were not uncooperative with police. I know that Kate, she's always responded to them. I don't know where. Well, I have a sense of where this came from, but I don't think that there's any reason to think at all that she's been uncooperative in any way with police.
Okay. Next one. Quote, Fred refused to be interviewed by state police homicide detectives for 2 years, and when he did, he brought two lawyers with him.
False. That is absolutely 100% false. There is an article in the Boston Globe that quotes Kelly Ayotte, who was the attorney general of New Hampshire at the time. And she says in, I believe this is a direct quote, Fred has had frequent contact with the state police and he sat down with her in recently, she had said like several months prior or something like that, to go over the case. So he was actually meeting with the attorney general of New Hampshire within the first year. And according to her, he had had frequent contact with the police. There's also a ton of news articles that quote him talking about the investigation. And as best as I can tell, the lawyer that he brought with him was the attorney who represented him pro bono, an attorney from Massachusetts named Tim Irvin, who helped him sue basically every law enforcement officer in the state at the time. I think that began in like January of 2005. And so I had actually had a chance to speak to him a couple of years ago. He passed away, unfortunately. But before that, I did talk to him about this, and he told me about meeting with him and the state police, and I believe Kelly Ayotte at one point. So the lawyers that the author refers to was probably Fred Murray's lawyer that was helping him sue the state of New Hampshire. So Fred was going after law enforcement. Law enforcement wasn't like coming after him and he was having to defend himself or something, which is sort of how it's portrayed. So that one, I have to say, completely false.
Okay. Here's another one. Campus security had evidence that she was last seen Sunday morning by a fellow student, and she was carrying a backpack, box of wine, and a large hockey bag full of beer. What do we know about this hockey bag full of beer?
So that was reported in the Valley News by a reporter named Kelly White. It hasn't been reported anywhere else, and I sort of have a hard time understanding how this person, witness, could have known what was in the hockey bag, that it was full of cans, bag of beer, is what they say. I don't know how you would know that, but I do know that there was no hockey bag recovered from the Saturn. So that one's a little bit hard to comment on, it, whether or not it was just sort of like a witness statement and not entirely accurate or just a mistake. But there's no evidence of a hockey bag, at least in the Saturn, that was recovered.
Okay. This next one real quick is in response to a question that was asked on another podcast. It was about a website that had been read about in an article written by Billy Jensen. It was spbowers.com/moremissing. The questions were, does Bill Rausch know this Scott Bowers? And why the original website was deleted and, quote, why he seemed to ghost himself on the internet and delete all his artwork and kart racing and pictures. So I actually reached out to Bill and asked him for a response to this. And what he said was this, quote, Scott Bowers was one of many friends who helped during our search for Maura, setting up a web page with photos of Maura, her physical description, reward information, and phone numbers to law enforcement for people to submit tips or other information. The web page did not have a feature to collect information from users and was never used for tips. Helena Murray would later create an entire website dedicated to Maura, making the original page redundant. Scott's website is no longer active. He and his wife maintain a healthy online presence to include regular posts on social media of their families, careers, and hobbies. I met Scott through Professor Rob McDonnell, who was childhood friends with Scott's wife. Scott and his wife met Maura in 2002 during a gathering at Rob McDonald's home. Scott was one of many friends and family members who helped us during the early days of our search for Maura, and we will be forever thankful for their contribution. So this person did not ghost anyone, and I, in fact, saw Facebook page's person. It exists. There's no ghosting. He has a perfectly normal Facebook page. Looks like probably most people's with, you know, family pictures and stuff like that. And there was no ability to collect tips. So those were the main questions, and I wanted to clear that up. Yeah, I wanted to answer it because when that was on the podcast, I thought, oh, I never heard of that. Let's see, you know, and he was kind enough to answer that for me.
Nice.
So I want to know, are there any allegations or things that have been stated as facts that stand out to you? Things that have been repeated over and over again, but we don't have any corroboration for, anything that we haven't talked about?
Yeah, there are a few. So one that stands out to me is the pregnancy, rumor theory, the idea that Maura was pregnant when she left. And the piece of it that's uncorroborated is it's been claimed that she had been searching for, terms related to alcohol and alcohol effects on a baby or a pregnant woman. And I don't think that that's accurate. I actually have a copy of the homework that she had submitted to her nursing cohort the morning that she disappeared. And their assignment was to Google maternity terms. It was for a maternity clinical and send them to each other. And the terms are things like Braxton Hicks and these other terms that I would have a hard time even pronouncing, but none of them had anything to do with the effects of alcohol on a pregnancy or on a baby. And so I think that that's one that there's just no evidence to suggest that she was pregnant. I mean, she was on birth control. She was doing a maternity clinical. Those are much better explanations for why she was searching maternity terms than the fact that she was pregnant. So so that's one.
And wasn't that corroborated on the oxygen special?
It was. It was. But it's still seems to sort of be out there, be a possibility that's out there. And of course, like any woman of childbearing age could be pregnant or might be pregnant at any time, but there's just no evidence for it.
Yeah, and just I just wanted to note that you had sent me those terms that you can't I'll read a couple of them. Duramorph, epidural anesthesia, Stadol, Nubain, Phenergan, bilirubin levels, posterior presentation, meconium, BRCA, one gene, Braxton Hicks. These are not things that have to do with can alcohol harm my baby. I know what, you know, some of these things are. You know what an epidural is, you know. So none of these things would be, yeah. Mara would be searching if she was worried about being pregnant. I think we can suffice to say that anyway. All right, go ahead. What other ones, you know, that come to mind?
There was also one that this was actually put out on the Oxygen show, and I was surprised that they didn't fact check it or get any corroboration, because I ended up contacting the Hadley police station to fact check it. And there's no reason to believe that there was any kind of either a DUI or reckless operations charge in the works, quote. I believe that's the way the author termed it in the book. There was nothing. There was no pending charges against her. And I think that was used to give her a motive to want to flee. I think that the idea that she ran away is probably a little antiquated at this point, but I still do hear that one. And there was no pending charges for that car accident. There was no property damage. There was no intent to drive recklessly or endanger the lives of others or anything like that. So that's another one.
Okay.
And this one, I hear it a lot and I understand why, but it's the idea that Mara started her car seven times or tried to start the ignition seven times after she got into the accident. And that's 100% false. She did not try to start her car seven times and was unable to do so. That was something that Art Roderick had said on the Nancy Grace podcast, and it's sort of been repeated over and over again, but he seems to have misinterpreted the forensic report. There was no inertia switch in the Saturn, and I double-checked that with the analysts that actually put together the report. There was nothing that would happen to the fuel supply when or if the car was in an accident, so she could have started that car right up, and very likely did, given like the tire impressions and the witnesses who said that they saw the car backing up. So that's another one that seems to be repeated often that is just not the case. She could start the car.
Okay. All right. Is there anything else that we didn't cover that I didn't ask you that you think is important?
I would just also add that it seems like in this case in particular, it's almost like completely backwards in the sense that all of the questions and sort of badgering online discussion about the friends and family who won't talk or aren't being cooperative, quote, they don't have any obligation to go on a podcast or to come on Reddit and talk to people. And it's almost like there's like too much focus on that when there's this whole case file that exists in New Hampshire and this law called literally the right to know. and we can be, you know, making some effort to get information from that file as opposed to just like badgering these people that have absolutely no obligation to talk to us whatsoever. And you're only likely making it less likely that they're going to want to come out and talk to you by continuing to badger them. So it's not a very like coherent point, but it's, I guess my point is that there should be slightly more respect on the people, on the personal lives of people that have no obligation whatsoever to speak to podcasters or Redditors or bloggers or anyone else, really.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, my perspective on it is a lot like what they tell you when you go into a beautiful forest or something, a state land or state park. And they ask you to please leave it in the condition that you found it and not leave a bunch of your garbage there trailing as you leave. And I feel like as podcasters, we have that obligation as well. We have an obligation to do no harm, to add to the understanding of a case and a victim's, what they're going through and the family who are also victims. But if what we're adding is more grief and pain to families, or if what we're adding is just more garbage, then we need to start asking ourselves, what are we doing? How are we benefiting this family or this case? And so, I urge people to think about that. And I don't want this to be a preachy thing. I don't mean it that way, but it is kind of, because I think in this case, we've gotten to that point where we need to have that chat, you know, so it's just, it is something that I think we should think about. And, you know, with regard to Mara's case specifically and all the many theories you and I have discussed, or I don't want to speak for you. I feel like there's not enough focus on Haverhill, and there's mm-hmm. so much more focus on UMass and the other stuff. It's way disproportionate at this point. And I'd like to give a disclaimer right now. And I've done it on Twitter, but I'm going to do it again because apparently people either don't believe the words coming out of my mouth on the computer screen or whatever. I am very confident saying that Bill Rausch may have done the things that he was accused of doing.
Right.
That could happen. I don't know. I'm not familiar enough with that case. What I do know, what I'm also comfortable saying, is that I don't have a clear enough picture. No one has even remotely articulated a theory that comports with the evidence that we have right now that shows that he could have killed Mora. So if you can't even articulate a theory that makes sense other than really stretching, then maybe you're stretching because what you want to believe is not there. And fine, I'm telling those people, keep looking at Bill. That's fine. You're going to have to do what you're going to have to do. But can we not at least have an equal amount of time on the local area, on Haverhill? Does it have to all be about Bill? Because if that's the case, if it's not him, how are you going to feel if she's found and we realize he had nothing to do with it? How are these people in this community going to feel if Haverhill is the key and nobody's paying attention to the key because they're all distracted about other things? Mm-hmm. And we have somehow contributed to people not coming forward. I mean, that would be pretty tragic, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I don't know if this is too harsh or not, but I mean, anyone who is trying to disincentivize getting more information, trying to make it harder to get information, you have to wonder like what their goal really is. I think it's been one of my biggest criticisms of some of the other coverage, because the way that a case is framed, like you said, obviously has, or maybe not obviously, but it does. It has a huge impact on how it pans out, whether witnesses decide to come forward or not, and potentially like on how justice is either served or not. And so I know that the reality is that, you know, having 10 episodes on the boyfriend may not be the best thing if you, like you said, want to get witnesses from Haverhill to start talking, because they may think that, well, what I have to say is completely irrelevant.
Exactly. They might buy into that. So what I would say is, what conclusions can we draw about what the police think in this case? What are they doing? So I reached out to Bill and I asked him, I said, when was the last time that anyone in law enforcement talked to you about Mora's case? And he said, February of 04. And I said, what about your mom? And he said, I don't know. Let me ask her. So he texted her and he sent me the screenshots. And Sharon Rausch said, the last time that she spoke to law enforcement was, quote, I think when I spoke to the NHSP chief trying to correct Scorinza, saying that there was a note from Bill to Mora. Anyway, a long time ago. She also thinks that was in 2004. And at that time, Bill's
yeah.
and his parents sat down with law enforcement when they arrived. And then there were never formal interviews of his parents. They weren't suspects. You know, there wasn't any reason for police to do anything but ask them what they knew. And then Bill himself was interviewed by police a few days later, and that was the only time they interviewed him. And he has never seen or heard from them again.
Right.
So what that tells me is police, at least as far as we know, police aren't chasing him around. You know, I don't know that they're looking at Bill as a suspect. And obviously we can't know what they're doing behind the scenes. But if they were focused on Bill, you'd think that they'd be questioning him more than that one time.
Mm-hmm.
So let's, for a moment, just for our purposes, let's say, what is law enforcement's focus? Well, they are searching multiple homes and residences in the local area. And that could mean that they're ruling out things. You know, that's also their job. They have to rule things out in order to keep other things in. Or it could mean that they believe that there is a local person involved, right? It could mean that that's what they think. And I remember hearing Art say that on one of the panels that he got a sense, and I'm paraphrasing here, but they got a sense that police knew who was responsible for Mora's going missing or death, but they didn't have enough evidence to prosecute this person.
Mm-hmm.
Because I see that a lot. My focus on my podcast is why cases go cold. I focus on that because just as a teaching mechanism. You hear things about cases in the media, but then when you get the case files, because I never cover cases unless I can get the case file. I don't feel comfortable with that. So when you get the case file, you realize that it's totally different than what people are speculating about. What's going on is totally different. But in most of the cases, they do know who it was. They just don't have what they need. So, you know, Fred appears to believe it's a local, right? I mean, don't you get that impression from him?
Yeah, I get that impression for sure. And most of the tips that he's gotten have been the same, you know, local dirtbags. So, I think so.
So if that's the case, and we think at least that's a possibility, it's got to be as much of a possibility as all these other things that we're talking about, tandem drivers and running off to Canada and whatever the theories of the day are. If that's the case, if a local is at least a possibility, then there's a couple things we need to keep in mind. What the prosecutors have right now and what they don't have. We don't have a body. We don't have a murder weapon that we know of. We don't have any actual signs of foul play, at least that we know of. And as someone who's covered a no-body case before, and I know you did some coverage on that, you had a good interview about that. In the one that one of the ones that they just made an arrest on, actually, but in that case, they had what I would consider a mountain of circumstantial evidence. They had direct evidence, physical evidence like blood in a vehicle, and they had witnesses who saw stuff. And the problem in that case were there were key players who did not come forward with everything they knew for years because they were intimidated and they were afraid. In a small town, everybody might know everybody, but that doesn't mean that everybody knows who did it. My experience was when I reached out to people to interview them, a lot of people didn't know who had done it. They had bought into some of the conspiracies or what they had heard. And so people with information had not come forward because they didn't know what they knew.
Right.
And so obviously no one's been arrested. So let's say that Art's right, and let's say that they do know who did it, but they don't have enough to arrest. And let's say it's a local. So let's ask ourselves for a minute, what might weaken the case of the prosecutor in Mora's situation? Remember, we have no body. Let's say a local is arrested and charged with her murder. What is any good defense attorney going to do if they don't find Mora, if we have no body, if they can't prove that she's dead? What's the biggest theory that you would expect the defense attorney to push?
Yeah, all the things that are out there right now. She ran away. She was her boyfriend, her father. Look at the relationship there. I mean, it's a roadmap for a defense attorney.
It is. They've got an entire book that outlines how she ran away to Canada. You know, I mean, and they don't need much. All they need is reasonable doubt. All they need to do is raise that little bit of doubt. Can you just see a defense attorney saying, my client didn't do it? And hey, look, there's this book that was written. Some people believe that there were credible sightings of her in Canada. She was pregnant. Mm-hmm. She was running away from her controlling boyfriend and her horrible father. I mean, all they have to do is sow reasonable doubt. Like you said, the defense attorney here has a playbook that they could use. And so I guess what's like at the top of my mind as we end this is that I would ask people to consider what we have as a community, how our actions have affected the cases we cover, podcasters in general. Are we doing justice to the victims, or are we making it harder for them to get justice? That's what I would hope that people would maybe start focusing on.